Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling ruminative.
Sorry?
Yes, I am. I am feeling ruminative. I am in deep thought. And I was listening earlier to Joni Mitchell's Both Sides Now. It got me thinking about the idea that, because she's talking about how she sees clouds from both sides now, and how she thinks she knew the clouds, but she didn't quite know them. And it got me thinking about how in popular culture and in society, we often like to pin people down and we like to think we know what someone's talent is or what they mean to us. And often that is just one thing, which you and I have been railing against ever since we started Talk Art, because like yourself, you're an actor who loves art. You know, I'm an ex-musician who became a gallerist. Like we like people who think outside the box. And
they switch lanes. We're like people who are switching lanes.
Exactly. And I also just think to be really great at one thing, you actually have to have interest in loads of other things. And today's guest is an extraordinary, iconic actor. And I mean, everybody listening to today will know his work, of course. But his role as James Bond was obviously one of the highlights of his career. But I always remember when I saw the first film he did, how brooding the performance was. And there was this kind of like emotional depth that felt new to Bond. And I think that definitely has been informed by his personal life and also his passion for art, which is just so exciting. And it's a side to him that I wasn't aware of, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners aren't aware of. So I just think it's a good thing to keep an open mind and to realize that people can have many talents, not just one. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Pierce Brosnan.
Thank you, guys. Hi, Robert. Hello, Russell. Hello, everyone out there.
Hello.
Well, it's lovely to
Where
be.
Are you in the world, Pierce?
I'm sitting here at my kitchen table on the island of Kauai. And this is where we've been living for a number of years. And now it's become our mainstay in life. But it's a very brooding, kind of ruminative morning of weather here, too. We've got a huge front coming in. So you might hear some claps of thunder. You might hear the chickens in the background here. I just fed all my chickens
Getting
this morning. And that's where you find me. Well, it's really good to talk to you guys. You do wonderful work. I've enjoyed many of your podcasts. So thank you for having me on the show.
Of course. Well, we love your work. So this sort of weather that's coming in, is that kind of inspiring to you? Because have you set up a studio where you are living now? You must have done.
Oh, I have a studio here, yes. This house is very small. It's a three-bedroom cottage, really. But it sits right on the water's edge. And down at the back of the land, there's a yurt. And that has been my studio for a number of years. But it gets very hot painting in a yurt. So I've rented the neighbor's house next door. And it's a beautiful space for the work. And I'm working on larger pieces now, 65 by 54. So those are very big. And so I have about four of those canvases up. And it's a glorious space. And there's about, you know, six pieces that I'm working on at the same time. I'm not sure what that says about me. I think it's attention deficit, probably. But they all interact with each other, these paintings. And
let's talk about that, because a lot of people wouldn't know that you are a visual artist, that you paint, but you've said yourself that you've painted for years, but the last few years you've taken it really seriously. But you started painting in 1987, is that right?
I did. That's when it really, really kicked in. I mean, I left school at 17 with nothing really, but a kind of qualification in English and art and a cardboard folder that I made to house my paintings and drawings, and went to seek employment as a 17-year-old. And, you know, I wanted to be an artist, knowing that I really didn't have the kind of academic background. But luckily, I had good fortune, and I found a job at a small studio in Putney called Ravenna Studios. And, yes, I was one of four other artists. I basically made the tea and drew straight lines and watered the spider plants, and thus started my kind of artistic life, as it were. But, you know, about 3-4 years in, I discovered acting, and acting took over my life. And, you know, I went off to the drama center, and Chalk Farm there, the old drama center, and studied. And had, you know, I've been employed ever since I left drama school in 76. And then I went to America and in 82, and for the first time I had, you know, money in my pocket, and I went out and I bought myself paints and easels, and they just went into a cupboard and they remained there until 1987.
You started in commercial illustration, right? Is that your route in? And you came from Ireland to the UK.
Yes, I left Ireland in 1964 as a young lad. Hopped on a plane there with my little cardboard suitcase. And anyway, I left Ireland in 64, and I was 11 years of age. And then I left England when I was 26 for America. And America's been my home ever since. I left school, as I said, at 17 with really nothing more than a cardboard folder of drawings and paintings. And that simple brown cardboard folder of paintings and artwork was my kind of passport out to this life, really, as an artist, as a painter, as an actor. I went down Fleet Street and was kind of shown the door promptly by various people who looked at my work with a kind of jaded eye. But then I found this wonderful studio in Putney, South London, called Ravenna Studios. And they gave me a job. It was £10 a week. And basically, I watered the spider plants, drew straight lines, and made cups of tea and did some paste-up work. and then I discovered acting. I went to the Oval House Theatre one night down there in Kennington, started doing workshops, and thus the career as an actor began. But the art kept a mild continuity within my life. But I eventually came to America. I came out here in 82 doing a TV series called Remington Steel. So I was making money. I bought myself art supplies, mm-hmm. canvases and easels and paints. And they just sat in a cupboard, languishing. And then my late wife, Cassie, God bless her, she got sick with cancer. And I think it was around 87. She was diagnosed in 86, 87. One night, the fear and the anguish of dealing with such a disease, you know, kept me awake. And I got the paints out and I set up the easel and I started painting. And I started painting with my hands, actually. And those two pieces, seminal pieces, which I still have. And then I got a little bit more form to the work and composition to the work. But the practice started really in 87, and it's been consistent since.
And that first painting, Dark Knight, that you painted with your hands, like you say, it is a really seminal work for you in the sense that the use of colour, and also there's a kind of a soul to the work, which is obviously because of the psychological, you know, time you were having at that point, I guess, the emotional side of it. But I feel like art for you has been this kind of therapy or something. Like you really feel that authentic, you know, representation of your interior world in your paintings, I think.
It really has become very much a meditation and a therapy. When I look at the work that I'm doing now, of these large pieces on canvases, which are 64 by 54, what I've done is that they come from a collection of drawings, phone call drawings. Mm-hmm. So when I'm on the phone having meetings, I have a pen and paper with me. And these drawings materialize, and what I've done is taken the drawings and blown them up on canvases, and now I'm painting into them. So they're strange elliptical pieces, but they have a certain kind of lyricism to them.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, when I go on tour, I'm working on movies, I always set up a studio wherever I am in the world. And I have collections of work from various movies. And it works hand in hand with being an actor, and it alleviates some of the stresses and strains of being an actor. Yeah. You live in your own kind of solitude as a painter, and you actually somewhat live in your own solitude as an actor too, because you're always preparing the work and you have an interior dialogue going on. But the painting has become more pronounced as the years have rolled on.
Yeah. So prior to becoming an actor, you fundamentally wanted to be an artist. You started in commercial art. At one point, you worked in Harrods, which I want to ask you about. But that was a career path that you were completely channeling. You came from Ireland to London to pursue being an artist, right?
I did. As I say, you know, I really had nothing but the art to keep me alive, to give me some motivation. And
how did you find it as a kid? How did art come into your life?
Well, I didn't have it as a young boy in Ireland growing up. It was never there. It wasn't until I was a teenager, really living in London, and going to Putney Comprehensive School, which was a kind of a wild and woolly place back then in the 60s. You know, it was every man for himself. And the art really sustained me and nourished me. I would have loved to have gone to Chelsea Art School or to Slade. But again, my shortcomings were that I didn't have the qualifications. So I was behind the eight ball. So when you're in that situation, you know, you have to... you hold on to what you have with a strong conviction. And I wanted to, you know, I dreamt of doing album covers and advertising. But like I say, the acting came out of left field, and I just flourished with that.
What was you doing at Harrods? What was the job there?
Well, I was at drama school. I was at the drama center, and you know, you had to get, I was on a scholarship, so I had to find work during the summer, and this was actually Christmas time, and I worked down in the packing department, wrapping Christmas presents.
Did you? Yeah, I've got written here that you did line and wash drawings. I thought you were doing like window displays or something.
No, heavens, no. I was just a schlepper down in the bowels of Harrods.
Although wrapping presents is a fine art in itself, it's something that I've never mastered. But didn't you actually study at Central St. Martin's as well? Because I was like really surprised to see that on your CV for some reason.
No, I didn't study at St. Martin's. The Drama Centre the Drama Centre is now at St. Martin's. So I think there might have been some confusion there. I have no formal art training whatsoever.
So you're technically like self-taught then? You're a self-taught artist?
I am a self-taught artist.
But what I love about your style, Piers, is that there's so much of lots of artists that kind of come and go into your your paintings when people look online now and see your work if they've not come across it before. But there's so many elements that you yourself have pored over and obsessed over with books on Matisse and Picasso. I've read that you went out and you just devoured all the information you could to find out what great art was and what great artists were doing.
Well, again, it goes hand in hand with my life as an actor. I'm constantly on the road. And so that existence can be quite solitary as well. And so you find yourself, and luckily I find myself in magnificent cities all around the world. And as I say, the first thing I do when I get to a hotel or an apartment or a house is set up a studio and consequently then go and find the local artists or find the museums. So my education is always ongoing. And the influence of Matisse, Kandinsky, Chagall, you know, and everything leads back to Picasso for me too. Yeah. But I've allowed that to kind of influence my own work. And, you know, the piece that I celebrated here recently, this silk screen print of earplugs that was made at Leavesden Studios when I was doing Goldeneye. And, you know, that just became a meditation for me, making a movie on that scale for 6 months. You know, there are maybe weeks that go by where you don't have any scenes. You're just doing action scenes. And so the painting was a great meditation and comfort for me. And out of it came earplugs. You know, I'd long admired Roy Lichtenstein's ability to organize a graphic element into a painting and to amplify the mundane into this kind of bedazzling image. And so we had these, you would be given earplugs most days when you'd have an action sequence, and on the back was a graphic illustration of how to put the earplugs into your ear. And I just found the infographic of that to be intriguing, you know, amusing, engaging. And I just kind of wanted to see if the composition would work as a painting. So that's how earplugs came about. And,
but was that a studio? Did you have a studio next door to the movie set? Would you, like, between scenes, would you go and start working on paintings and this infographic that you created into a work of your own?
Well, no, I had a dressing room. It was a very wonderful, large, old office room.
Yeah.
Leavesden Studios, they used to build, it was a Rolls-Royce factory. And during the Second World War, they used it to manufacture planes as well. So I had a lovely dressing room, and it was very spacious, and it had north-facing light windows. And that's where I set up my easel. And two paintings came out of that period of 6 months, and Earplugs is the one that I've set sail with in these last few months to kind of...
Yeah, why did you choose that one? And out of all of your paintings from your kind of career, why was it Earplugs the one that you really decided to release as this edition now, which is a 100 silkscreen edition that you've just brought out?
I think it comes with many tones of story. There's James Bond, there's me as a painter, there's the relationship to Roy Lichtenstein's work. And I thought it was all-encompassing as a formal piece to set on the stage, as it were. And it just seemed to work.
Yeah, right.
It seemed to have its own life force.
Is it exciting turning a painting into an edition?
It was very exciting. Yeah. Yes, yes. I received the print there about 6 weeks ago, and opening up the artwork and seeing it for the first time was exhilarating. This wonderful studio in Los Angeles called Ranch Studios. They worked on the piece. Mm. And I'm working with an LA-based gallery called Seasons.
Yeah.
And to put out this limited edition. So it will be the first of, I hope, many. And looking at my work now, I look at it and I would like to move into ceramics.
Oh, yeah, great.
I've taken a portrait of Keeley that I did many years ago, and we've developed it. We've taken that and made it into a vase.
Oh, wow.
So that's a possibility. There's abstract shapes in my work, which yeah. I would like to...
Can I make a suggestion for one?
Yes.
That I love from 1994, the Irish Rothko, which I think is an incredible work.
Thank you.
And you need to make that into an edition.
The Irish Rothko. Oh, cheers. Yeah, that's... well, the bull in that was painted when I was making the movie The Matador. And two pieces of work came out of that. One is a self-portrait of me as Julian Noble, who is the main character in The Matador. And the other one was the bull. And the bull sits by itself on a canvas, unfinished. And so I was playing around on the laptop, and Rothko's painting, I can't remember what it's called, just intrigued me. And I put the image of the bull on top of the Rothko, and it became Rothko's bull.
I love it. They're so autobiographical, your works, then, and it feels like they really correlate between and reference your acting. There's like an absolute unity between your creative output as an artist and your creative output as an actor.
Well, thank you for saying so. Yes, I mean, they're all biographical, and I the work comes from its own emotional kind of landscape of where I am in life, but very much so with the work as an actor. And I've tried plein air painting here. I live in Hawaii and it's very beautiful. And I go out with a good friend who's become a mentor, and I try my hand at plein air painting, but I fail miserably. I love the studio work. My drawings, I have many sketchbooks now, and I draw constantly every day.
Wow. How often are you in the studio? Are you in the studio every day as well?
I go to the studio every day, if just to make a cup of tea and clean the brushes or sweep the floor and just sit and look at them. And before you know it, I try to, I give myself 30 minutes. And then, of course, you know, the morning disappears into the afternoon. And, you know, you can stand back and look at some advancement of the work. But especially now in this time of COVID, it's become necessary for me to alleviate the stresses and strains of this world we find ourselves in. And the painting and the studio really helps that. I'm not sure when I'll get back to work as an actor. I have two films lined up for this year. But I'm not sure. They keep getting pushed back. Yeah. So in the meantime, I've been working on my...
It's so good.
Practice.
It's so good that you have that other outlet. What do you mean you give yourself 30 minutes, though? You give yourself 30 minutes contemplation or 30 minutes practice?
No. A friend of mine said, just go in and just do 30 minutes. Just give yourself 30 minutes. Because sometimes it's hard to go to the studio.
So you go daily, right?
Yeah, just so you go in and do something, show up. And just sitting with the work can enliven you and inform you. And just by making a mark, by starting somewhere into a painting. I've brought paintings from LA down here to the island, and you know, about 26 canvases that are unfinished. So I'm working on those, and then I've developed these phone call drawings into paintings.
I love them.
And so yes, it's become a more meaningful reality to me, this life of being a painter or wanting to be a painter. Sir Anthony Hopkins says it takes 20 years to make an actor, and he's not far off the mark, but he was great from the start. But, you know, to have creative life, artistic life, it's all in the doing. You have to do it. You can talk about acting, but then you have to do it. You can talk about painting, but then you have to make a mark on the on the page, on the canvas.
Is it a different feeling of creativity between acting and painting for you?
Well, being a painter is very solitary. It's you, the brush, the canvas. Being an actor, it's a collaboration. You both deal with the imagination and dealing with an emotional, you want to have an emotional impact. You try to be an unexpected surprise, certainly as an actor. And, you know, with the painting, I want to make work that pleases me first and foremost, and then hopefully will have some presence on the wall and maybe have some power on the wall and something that is decorative. I love Matisse's terms for it. You want work that's pleasing. As an actor, I wanted to be, you know, I was trained in the method and very heavy preparations, but I wanted my work to reach many people. I wanted to be a commercial actor. Like, I want to be a commercial painter.
You do, right.
And to sell work, and that's not that it's not about the money, but, you know, the earplugs piece that we're just releasing, we're doing that in association with a wonderful organization called A Sense of Home, which enables young men and women who at the age of 18 are leaving the foster care system. And so the proceeds from the work will go towards A Sense of Home, and I think that's a continuity of work and art and engaging with young people's lives that I hope goes on.
And actually, it's quite interesting to think of your career with you traveling around the world all the time, being this kind of itinerant, you know, actor, but the way that art and the studio has become this kind of home that travels with you, both in the soulful sense, but also in a literal sense, in the fact that you have somewhere to return to. But I was really interested in that connection to charity as well, because I know that you've given a lot of your life to activism as a kind of third career in a sense, because you've done so much for charities around the world. But there's a really amazing story that one of your paintings of Bob Dylan, like, raised an incredible amount of money for charity, for the AMFAR AIDS charity at an
Foundation,
auction in 2018. I love that story. Can you speak a bit about that painting and that whole journey to that auction?
And by the way, it sold for 1.2 million
$1.4?
To some Ukrainian billionaire called Marina Acton.
Wasn't it 1.4 million?
Oh, maybe with the...
It was 1.4.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
You lost 2 million, though.
200 grand, not 2 million.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, it was... my wife, Keely, made a documentary called Poisoning Paradise. And she was invited to the Cannes Film Festival. They heard that I was a painter, and they asked me to submit a painting. And I had this piece in the studio. It was of Bob Dylan. It's a portrait of Bob Dylan. And I brought that along. She went off with her movie under her arm, and I went along with this portrait of Bob Dylan, and I thought I'll submit it for the charity of AMFAR. And it was a big night in Cannes, and it was an exhilarating moment to walk onto the stage with the painting and to talk about the perniciousness of AIDS and what it has done to our society. And I said, this is my contribution to the evening. And it started at 30,000, which I thought was a huge amount of money. And the bidding commenced, and it came down at 1.4 million this lady called Marina Acton, who loves my work. But again, it was a kind of a win-win situation. I knew that the painting is good. It has a strong feel to it. And, you know, James Bond, Bob Dylan, Pierce Brosnan, a painting. So it had a bit of oomph.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful, wonderful evening. And
he's your hero,
and Marina
Bob
Acton. He's one of my heroes, yes. I mean, there's Bruce and there's David. So I did a piece, a portrait of Fidel Castro, a couple of many years back, and that led me to the Bob Dylan. And so consequently, I've started one on David Bowie, John Lennon, and hopefully I will have a collection of musicians that Amazing. Are meaningful to me and a part of my history as an actor.
And Bob's seen it, right? Bob's seen this portrait you've done.
I sent him one, yes.
Did
I
you?
Did. Yes. Well, his son, Jacob, is a friend. And so I gave one to Jacob and said, maybe you could pass this along to your dad. And I think he liked it very much. And of course, Bob Dylan is a very fine artist too. He's a wonderful painter.
Yes,
that's right.
Yes, and you know, there's a lot of us actors and musicians out there, as you so well know yourselves, who you know, live a creative life as painters.
Did Marina acquire any more of your paintings after that, or did she have works before?
She has a few other pieces, which are lithos and gicle. The Bob Dylan was wonderful too, because it introduced me to a EDM Studios in Paris. I went down there and they did the lithograph of Bob Dylan for me. And again, we were in Paris for a festival, film festival. I met a young artist, Asian artist, and she's a wonderful line drawer. And she said, you should go along. Her name is Christine. And she said, you should go along to EDM Studios. And it's one of the oldest studios in Paris. Chagall was there, Mondrian,
wow.
Picasso. And it's this kind of ancient medieval factory. David Lynch is there. He holds a studio there. And they invited me along, and I went off that morning in a cab. I brought my sketch pads with me. And luckily I did, because when I got there, they had laid out all the limestone blocks, various sizes, with oils and pencils. And so I immediately went to work. I thought, I'll do this. I did it was a self-portrait, a beautiful palm tree and a Buddha head and a court jester. And they started turning out my work. And consequently did the lithographs of the Bob Dylan. And so that it's been in, you know, I'm a student. I'm a constant student. And because I'm self-taught, it's there's a great liberation in that, but then there's a great struggle within it, because, you know, especially with the painting, blending the colors that work compositionally, the tones, there's a whole area of vocabulary that I don't know about, that I'm constantly exploring. Bumping into the furniture as I go along. But I never give up on a painting. I try to finish every canvas as much as possible to find some truth in it and find something that... And some of my pieces, you know, have maybe two or three paintings underneath it, because I don't like throwing away my canvases. So, yes, the canvas finds its own kind of humanity given time and patience.
Now, talking of chairs, you mentioned that you'd shipped over paintings from Los Angeles, and one of my favorite paintings by you is called Malibu Chair, or Chair from Malibu, I think. But I really love the chair series that you've been working on. Can you speak a bit about those?
The chairs have become most enjoyable aspect of the work this last year. And the one that you like, the Robert Malibu chair, is a dining room chair that sits in the house. It's an old Spanish chair that I've sat in for many years. The chair and the table I've sat at. And it has its own personality. And there's something quite emotional about a chair when you look at it, the absence of a friend. They're like portraits, self-portraits in some way, in the sense that I live with them, and they're functional, and there's just something kind of mysterious about them when you look at a chair and the friend that was there or the people that have sat in that chair. So I've got about four of them so far. I'm looking at six to do six. I'm on the fourth. And there's something kind of very comforting about drawing a chair. And of course, one of the famous chairs is Vincent van Gogh's chair. That's one that has always captivated me. And when I see it, there's something, I don't know, just uplifting. And Hockney felt the same way, and Hockney did his version of Van Gogh's chair. And David Hockney is someone whose work I admire greatly. So that's where I'm at with the chair series. Mm-hmm. And I have the drawings, the phone call drawings, which are very big and a challenge. There's the chair drawings that are going at the same time. And I'm also doing King's Heads. Mm. Last year, I made a movie of Cinderella with Camilla Cabello, who's wonderful artist, singing artist, yeah, and becoming a fine young actress. So she played Cinderella. And Idina Menzel played the fairy godmother, the wicked stepmother, I should say. Billy Porter played the fairy godmother. Mm. I played the king. Enough. Minnie Driver played the queen. Amazing. So here I am playing the king. And in my scripts, I draw all the time. Oh. And I use my scripts as references. So I started doing, again, they're like self-portraits, a king, a crown, forlorn, abandoned, dejected, and this gallerist who lives close by, he said, I love the king's heads. You should do a series of those. So I've got about 10 of them, drawings, paintings, and I'm also doing lino cuts. I like lino cutting. And this is my so own amazing. Printing.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
So you're hoping to do a show, like a public show of this, or are you hoping to like sell them to collectors?
Well, I was geared up to, at the end last year, to do a show. And I found a space. Chuck Arnaldi is a magnificent painter, California artist, and someone whose work I've admired since 1982 when I discovered him. When I arrived in Los Angeles, Almaraz, Carlos Almaraz, Chuck Arnaldi. So many, here we jump many years later, and I realized that Chuck more or less lives down the road. They have a home around the corner from us here in Hawaii. And he saw my work, and he said, I'd be happy to show your work at my studio. So last year we were going towards that occasion, but the COVID happened.
Yeah.
And so that's been put on hold. But yes, at some point I would like to have a show of the work.
So you don't, do you find like your painting's quite private then, or are you excited to get critiqued on your work and have people see what you've been doing?
Well, I'm making tentative steps onto the world of art. I mean, you guys are the first guys I've ever spoken to about art.
Oh, it's amazing.
So
we're honored.
This is not an easy task for me to do with you today, and the people you've had on your show are people that I really admire. So doing the work, painting the painting, making the lithograph is the joy. Then you have to talk about it, you know. Making the movies is my joy. I love making movies. I love being in the company of actors. There's nothing more satisfying than feeling fulfilled at the end of a day and saying, I really nailed that scene. I've got it. Now I can put that piece with this piece. And you begin to build a character. And then you have to sell the movie. Mm. And that's where it becomes tough. As I'm finding out, the vocabulary of being an artist and the how you discuss the work is... To a layman like me, I can't quite find the words at times why I do it or how I do it. But I would like to show the work. I think there's a body of work there that has an articulation and has a autobiographical stamp to it.
Yeah, totally.
And I've been asked to do the memoirs, and I struggle along with writing the memoirs. So I was thinking really of just making a book of the paintings from the show. And then you'd have the painting, and then you'd have just 500 words about your life at that time when you were making that painting.
Well, you have that on the website. You have your paintings on the website, and there's stories alongside them,
them,
which are fascinating. The one I want to know about, the one in 1989, the day the car got stolen. What happened
the day
there?
The car got stolen. My late wife, Cassie, and my stepchildren, Christopher and Charlotte. Sadly, I lost Cassie and Charlotte. Mm. They both lost their lives to ovarian cancer. Anyway, we went off to the countryside to see some friends, and we drove our little Mini down to Rains Park to the station, hopped on the train, went to the country, and I took a photograph of Cassie, Charlotte, Christopher, and the dog, Albert. And I made a painting from that. And it's that's the painting. That's the story of the painting. We actually, when we got back to Rains Park Station, our car had been stolen. So we had to walk. We had to walk a good few miles back because we didn't have any money.
Yeah, the autobiographical elements of all the paintings is just so amazing that I love this. They're real events in your life and they correlate to movies, but it's such a personal journey that you've been able to creatively fulfill through painting.
Well, thank you. Yes. They're all very personal. And again, my work has been, my late wife was a great supporter of my work. And my wife, Keely, now of 27 years, is just so supportive of my practice as a painter and is inspiring and is a muse. So I've had these two great women in my life who've given me the kind of the courage, the strength, and the fortitude to go on to try and be a painter. To be an artist, so I take good heart in that.
Can we talk about materials? Can we talk about, because you talked about lithographs and we talked about the painting and the fact that the painting is still, the elements of painting still revealing itself to you constantly and you're trying to navigate your way through how to do that. What materials are important to you as an artist? Like what easels do you use and brushes and acrylics and oils and what brands do you like to work with?
Well, I love acrylics, golden acrylics. I love the look of them, the texture of them. They they apply themselves well. I get sometimes cheap brushes, and sometimes I get very fancy brushes. And I don't have the greatest discipline in cleaning them, so it can get quite expensive. But this past year, I have been much more diligent in cleaning my brushes and taking care of the materials. Easels, I can't remember the names of them, but I have these because I've got these large pieces now. I have two hand-cranked easels, which I enjoy very much. It's a bit like Frankenstein and the monster, you know, cranking up the canvas and et cetera. Lyra pencils. I use a lot of colored pencils and I travel with them. And Lyra make beautiful, rich, lustrous oil pencils. I haven't done pastels. I find that very difficult. Pens. I love good, you know, pens that I have a supply. Can't remember what they're called, really. I just say, get me more of those silver pens. But
you know what, Piers? I find it so fascinating how free you are with your different disciplines. And it seems you're so kind of bold and like brave in a way. And I think it's quite unusual in a way, because some artists like focus very much on one thing. But I feel like even though you are making paintings and drawings and it is all linked, you do have this kind of freedom of approach to things. Like you mentioned lino cuts, which is a very specific thing,
and ceramics,
and then silk screens and ceramics. This kind of openness, and it's even though I know that I've read an interview with GQ, I think it was, you said something about not wanting to be sort of pinned down or kept to being in one place somehow with your work, but I think there is something that bonds all of it and connects all of it in a very unique way, which is the color palette, this kind of bold, bright, positive, hopeful, vital kind of color palette, which if you think of your hero David Hockney, you definitely share a sensibility of color, which is also super unique. Is that something you were aware of, or is it just like an instinct you have with color?
Well, it goes back to 1987 when I woke up that night with a belly and a heart and a head full of pain and not knowing and dealing with cancer. And I went to the canvas. Anselm Kiefer is an artist that I love, and he does very hard, dramatic work. And that's what I thought I was going to do, but the color came through. The color kept coming through, and I just let the color roar. I just take off with color. And
was that a surprise?
It's good. It was a surprise. It was very much a surprise that particular night when I did those first two pieces, and then I went back to more formal work and kind of tight and graphic work. You know, someone said to me there recently, you should play, do monochrome. I try monochrome, but it just, it's so boring. I want color. I want the clash of colors, and I want the drama of colors. I love it. It's what really just makes my, just gives me a great contentment.
Yeah.
So, and I don't know, I guess I'm searching.
I was going to say, do you still have dreams filled with abstract shapes that you did have as a child?
I don't. It's interesting you should bring that up, and I don't know how I said it or where I said it, but I do look at some of these abstract images that come through, and they do throw back to my childhood. For some reason, I dreamt in color as a young boy in Ireland, and these large floating abstractions would enter my dream time, and I guess Dreamtime is, you know, Dreamtime art, this piece that's behind me here is a piece of Dreamtime art, which I bought when I was on my first James Bond tour of duty selling GoldenEye. I was in Sydney and I found this wonderful piece by a young Aboriginal artist. And I love the Dreamtime of it all. I have a production company called Irish Dreamtime. And this painting is by an artist called Kurin Waroon. And I lost his name. It's about 25 years old, and it's been in this house for 20 years. And because I've been doing a few podcasts, he came out of the woodwork, and we've introduced ourselves to each other. So, so it's been my backdrop for many
Zooms.
Many of these Zooms.
Yeah, are you a big collector? Do you collect a lot of art?
I have pieces from artists that I've met. You know, Avi Kiriati is a wonderful artist. He hangs here in the house. He's an island painter. And they become friends, you know, when I go to different parts of the world. I find the local artists. I'm introduced to artists. Mika Popovic, when I was in Belgrade many years ago, Stefan Chesney, who's a wonderful friend and an inspiration to me. He lives in Saint-Tropez, very much in the vein of Matisse. But so I don't really collect that much, no. All my paintings are in storage, and you know, Keely, my wife, has been pushing me this last year or so to show the work, to let it go.
Yes.
And so I've set sail on having a show at some point.
That's
I'm
so exciting.
Having some studio interviews next week.
Oh, great. But also, I read that in 2018, when you sold that Bob Dylan painting, you had something like 153 paintings you'd made. So you're obviously, is that true? Like, are you quite prolific and free in the amount of work you make? Because it's so exciting.
That's a collection, though, of work that's there.
It's amazing.
Since 87.
Cool.
And some of them I've worked back into, and some of them just... Some of them work, some of them don't. I think I would, if I have a show, I have a collection of about 25, 30 pieces.
Amazing.
There's a wonderful printer down in downtown LA that I've been doing a series of drawings with. His name is Francesco Siqueiros. And when the Malibu fires happened, I had a number of portraits done that came out of that emotional turmoil, and he's done some wonderful work for me.
Wow.
So, you know, and the larger pieces that I've got now, there's one called Fish Hook, which comes from the phone call drawings. That's a very beautiful piece. It came out of the passing of my friend back there last year from COVID, talking to his wife, and this drawing just popped up. So this painting is called...
It feels like they're so therapeutic. Your art feels so linked to, you know, traumatic moments that have happened, that have tested you. It feels like really you've had this medium to channel that into. It feels pretty important to you.
It is now. It is at this, you know, time in life. And, you know, 67 years have gone by with the speed of a flame. And I've been an actor all my life, and I've had good success, and I'm still passionate for it. But the work of being a painter, which was my first endeavor, my first big dream, is slowly being realized. And that's, you know, that comes with a great exhilaration. And you know, you're dealing with time past, time present, time future. So what do you do with that time, and how do you use it to the best of your advantage? So I'm exploring everything. I just met there's a wonderful wood carver here on island. So he's setting
so you're doing
me
wood
up
carving as well now. So now wood carving.
You're going to be a master wood carver next. I love this. I love your enthusiasm.
There is no limits to your talent. Yeah. You have studios all over the place whenever you've worked. But I want to ask about one particular studio you held at Steven Spielberg's house. What was that like? How did that come about?
Well, we have a home in Malibu, and we had a fire at our house. And we had to find another place to live. And Steven Spielberg's house was one house over, and it was for rent. And we went in there. And it was as simple as that. Steven doesn't live there anymore. He sold the house.
Right.
And it wasn't even his house at the time. He had lived there for a number of years.
Oh, okay.
And so I found myself there, and I had a lovely studio, and I've got four pieces of work that I made in that. I found a room, and I set up a studio. You know, and studios can be just the kitchen table. It can be a corner of the room. But I have the luxury now, as I say, right next door to me here in Hawaii, I have this beautiful space. And I go in every day and say hello to them all and make a cup of tea and put on my apron and attempt to, you know, move the needle and finish them. It's easy to start them. It's finishing the darn things.
Do you find it difficult to sort of share them with the world? Because I almost feel like you don't somehow, because like your website's got a number of your works on there. And I was looking through them all, and a few of the ones that touched me the most were like the most personal ones. So like the 1980s kind of very large painting of a drawing that a doctor did of cancer. And then I think you turned it into this very beautiful kind of bright colored abstract painting. And also you mentioned the passing of your daughter, and in 2013, the painting you did of yourself, I think, crying in Serbia. But like those paintings are just extraordinary. And they really touched me, like deeply touched me without, you know, but before I knew what the stories were, they really speak to me, you know. And I think that's great art, you know what I mean? And was that difficult for you to open up so personally, like, or is it okay because it's through the form of painting?
Oh, I think it's just being Irish and confessional. Too confessional.
Love that.
So, giving it all away.
Yeah.
Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been many years since I've been to confession. I don't know. No, not really. I mean, I haven't come to that point of putting them up on a wall yet. I mean, I think that time will come. And but I'm strong enough, bold enough to go and do it. And wonderful. If not now, when? To show the work. And I like the work. The work has power in my heart. And, you know, you can take your best shot. And I've already been, you know, had enough swipes taken at me as an actor. You know, you have to be tough as old boots to be an actor. You know that, Russell, yourself. Mm-hmm. It's a brutal game. It's constant constructing and destroying to create something. But thank you for saying that, Robert. It means a lot. And that particular painting was it was during the passing of my daughter to cancer, and so it has the blackbirds of mystery in it.
I like the fact that you like your own work. So I read somewhere that someone said that if you like your own work, that in itself is success. If you appreciate your own talent, and you are incredibly talented,
100%.
So and we ask every guest that comes on two very the same questions. And the first one is, Pierce, and this is really good because this harks back to the Thomas Crown Affair, which is this is the reason we ask this question for everybody that comes
basically,
on.
Basically, I was obsessed with the 1999 version of the Thomas Crown Affair, which you star in. And when we first started the podcast, I said to Russell, we're going to ask everyone what their art heist would be because that's my favourite movie. Yeah. Little did I know we'd actually one day be interviewing
you.
It's super. And Renée Rousseau, we have to give her a shout out because I love Renée Rousseau so much.
I love Renée Rousseau. It was her birthday, I think, a few days ago. And again, you know, one of the great joys for me of doing James Bond was creating my own company, Irish Dreamtime, and working with, sad to say, my late partner, Beaumarie St. Clair, whose life was also struck down by cancer, unbelievably so. But we created a company, Irish Dreamtime, on the heels of my success with GoldenEye. To make movies. And Beaumarie was from Malibu. She was a Malibu lady. And we both loved Steve McQueen. He was certainly one of my cinematic inspirations. Him, Clint Eastwood. I'd go to those movies and I'd, you know, come out and hop on the bus back home. And I'd be that character. I'd be that kind of movie star character in my head. So I've always had that feeling of having the camera, which is kind of narcissistic and strange and mangled in some way that you're being observed. But over coffee one morning when we were working on our first movie, which is called The Nephew, which is a beautiful little film set in Ireland, we started talking about Steve McQueen. And we said, what about doing a remake of the Thomas Crown Affair? And the studio bought it. MGM, they owned, it was on their shelf. So we were playing in the wheelhouse of the studio. And that movie couldn't have been a greater success for me and everyone in it, really. And as a painter in the making, I wanted to hit the Metropolitan Museum. The studio wanted us to set it in L.A., hit the Guggenheim. I said, no, I want to hit the Met. This is where I want to play. This is how I want to play it. And we hit the Met. And, you know, Monet's haystacks, the repetition of the haystacks, I found very intriguing. And this man is a man who's wealthy beyond words. And for me, it was a love story. And he didn't have love in his life. He didn't have that woman. He was adrift. He was rudderless, but extremely wealthy and with a very steel-trapped mind and a bravado of wanting to mess with the system. So he steals a painting. I love the Orsay Museum in Paris. And there's a hotel I stay in, and the Plaza Athénée, the Le Meurice Hotel on the Rue de Rivoli. And when a film is paying my way, they give me a nice room. And when I'm paying my own way, they give me this little suite at the top, a tiny room at the top. And it looks right across the Tuileries at the Orsay. And because I've been asked, would we do another Thomas Crown? And I've always thought it would be great to hit the D'Orsay Museum.
Yes.
Those two clocks dealing with time.
Awesome.
And in there, there's a wonderful Vincent van Gogh self-portrait, which would fit easily in a suitcase.
Amazing.
Just fit under your jacket so nicely.
There
you go. That's a rambling, roundabout way.
In the Thomas Crown Affair, was it your choice, the painting that got stolen?
No, it wasn't. I just wanted to steal a painting from the Met, and I love the Impressionists. Leslie Dixon, who wrote it, along with Kurt Wimmer. Leslie, I would have conversations with her about the love of his life, this woman, and then Kurt would talk about how to strike and hit a museum and how to steal it, how the heist would go down. But it wasn't me saying, you know, San Maggiore. I didn't pick that. I think Leslie picked it. And then, of course, when we had this magnificent screenplay, I gave it to John McTiernan. And John McTiernan was a friend. I was in his first movie when he left the AFI. It was a movie called Nomads with Leslie Ann Down. And so I thought that was going to be the start of my cinematic career, but it wasn't. John McTiernan went on to be great John McTiernan, and I went on my own way, and I've always worked as an actor. But I came to him with the gift of Thomas Crown, and he said yes. And so the synchronicity of my wanting to be an artist, a painter, the love of Steve McQueen and the Thomas Crown affair, you know, Steve McQueen was kind of rough and ready, rough-hewn, masculine player. And Thomas Crown was the first time he was ever really in a suit and dapper. And I know something about suit acting.
Yes.
Anyway, the Thomas Crown is definitely a jewel in the crown for me as an actor and as a lover of art. And you know, once the studio signed off on the Metropolitan Museum of Art, it was full steam ahead, and we shot the movie in New York City. But the Metropolitan Museum of Art wouldn't let us in. They only allowed us to use the stairs, the steps outside.
Oh, really?
So when he steals the painting, you know, it's, well, when you look at the film, you'll see Thomas Crown going into the museum, and then you'll see him coming down the stairs, having stolen the painting. The interior of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, we built in Yonkers in a car showroom. There was an abandoned car showroom in Yonkers, and they built three galleries of the Met Museum.
Ah.
And I had the joy of watching the set being built.
Wow.
And to absolutely the specifications of the three galleries, the color, the chair, and everything. So when you see the Metropolitan Museum of Art and you see Thomas Crown go walk through the galleries, that was all in Yonkers.
Wow.
And then one of the other great occasions was to see the art going up on the wall, and they were all printed and drawn, painted by this I've forgotten his name now, gosh, but they were all reproductions: Renoir's, Chagall's, Vincent van Gogh.
Did you take any at the end?
Because I did.
What did you take?
I took there's a Renoir, Mother and Child. There's a Gauguin, the Red Dog. There's a beautiful Vincent van Gogh, which I have in the studio back in Malibu, of Autumn Trees. And
that's like cherry picking, like masterpieces. I'll have one of those, I'll have one of them. That's amazing.
Well, you know, luckily my wife Keely said we better get our hands on some of these, and because the studio execs and a few other people, they got some major pieces too, no question. And you know, it was just a joy to kind of have a lunch break and to see the lads, you know, the crew sitting there in the Met having their lunch on set in front
so
of,
funny.
You know, a Renoir.
Underneath a Monet or something. Amazing. That's an amazing story.
We actually, the first song I ever recorded with my band, we actually used a sample of you guys talking, and it was René Rousseau stirring a glass of tea or something and sort of telling you off because you guys had a romantic tiff.
That's
and
right.
She's kind of like, you know, doing this very cool kind of phrase to you. And we used that at the beginning of
all our
concerts. Yeah, we sampled it at the beginning of all our concerts for Tempo
Nice.
Shot, my band. Hilarious.
Oh, nice. Excellent.
That's how much we loved the film anyway.
The other question we ask, Pierce, is what is your favorite color?
Yellow. Yellow. Oh, I mean, I don't know. There's just there's something harmonious about it. There's something that grabs me. There's a lot of yellow in my work. I don't know what it is, but I go to cadmium yellow a lot. But there's one I'm doing now, the fish hook, which again is comes out of the phone call drawings. And this particular piece of work is an homage to a friend that I lost last year, Jay Benedict, to COVID. He was best man at my first wedding. We were good mates. We were in the West End together in a play by directed by Franco Zeffirelli,
wow.
Godfather to his two sons. And Jay left us. And the day I was talking to his wife, Phoebe, again, I'm drawing as I'm talking, this fish hook piece came about. So I'm painting into that at the moment using pumice stone paint, heavy, and it's just light blues. It's all blues. So blue would be another great color.
Yeah.
But I do go to yellow very quickly, very easily.
Yeah.
Don't know why. Wow. It's just joyful.
It is. I've got one more thing I want to talk to you about because I want to be a fanboy because you're in one of my favorite movies of all time, Mrs. Doubtfire. And Robin was the reason I got into acting as a kid. And this is like an acting thing. What was it like working with him and what was he like and how was that experience?
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm a huge fan too. This man made me laugh like a drain. He just was magnificent. The irony is that I never really worked with Robin Williams. I only worked with Mrs. Doubtfire.
That's true. Yeah.
on the first day of, I went up to San Francisco on a summer's day and gorgeous. And they said, "Do you want to meet Robin? He's in the makeup and hair." And I said, "Sure, I'd love to." And this was at the start of the film for me. And I went in there to the makeup trailer, and there was Robin sitting in the chair with his kind of aloha Hawaiian shirt on, cargo pants, and UGG boots, and his hairy arms and legs hanging out. But he had the head of Mrs. Doubtfire. So I went in, and there was Robin, but he was his head was made up completely like Mrs. Doubtfire. And he said, "Oh, Pierce, you're so lovely. Oh, you are handsome, Pierce. Oh, come here, give us a kiss." And that's how I met Robin. He was a glorious man to work with. He was inspired. He was very human, very easy to be with, very just inspiring as an actor, very giving and free. So he created a wonderful ambiance on the set for everyone. Mm. And he played with heart, humanity, love, and, you know, such mischievous ways and a quicksilver mind. And he was much loved, you know, by all making the movie. And the film, again, you know, if I didn't do anything else, I did Mrs. Doubtfire and the Thomas Crown Affair and GoldenEye, you know. So there's a few of them. And as an actor, you want to, you know, hopefully you can look back and you can say, well, I made a mark there. I did something that can live on. And I think that's probably the spirit of artistic life, that you have some kind of immortality, that you create a movie that will be looked at and admired and cherished long after your day is done, or a piece of art that will be passed down or passed along that will have some transformation in people's lives. You know, it's living and dying. So that's
oh my God, it's heaven.
Thank you so
it
much.
It is heaven. Thank
it's
you for sharing
It's such a privilege
that.
To spend this
it's amazing.
Spend this time with you. It's been honestly. And you know what? You were my dad's favorite James Bond, and he passed away in 2015. And I thought tonight, before we started recording, like, I just thought, how amazing that we're like talking with you. So yeah, love from my dad to you, because he thought you were the best. And it's very cool having James Bond on Talk Art.
Yeah, James Bond on Talk Art.
It's like,
do you get called Bond? Like, you know, all presidents are always still Mr. President.
I get called Mr. Bond. Yes, you know, once you enter into that mansion, you know you're going to live with it for the rest of your life, and so you know to be handed the keys to such a proscenium arch and such an iconic character is a huge responsibility and daunting at the best of times, but exhilarating and the gift that keeps giving. So, you know, he has allowed me to create a life for myself and my family, and has given me some longevity on the stage. So I respect that and hold that dearly. So if that's all I'm known for, then so be it.
Well, I think your art speaks for itself now. I think so many people are going to discover your art practice now, and I cannot wait for your exhibition and for more people to discover your work. And everyone should look at this edition, Earplugs, the silk screen that's out now.
Yeah, you can see it at Seasons Gallery, and they're at seasons.la, which is their website. And also you can visit piercebrosnan.com. And Pierce is also on Instagram, like we are, and we'll be sharing images of all of your works that we've discussed in today's episode. And thank you, Pierce, for your generosity, because I think your art is a really generous act in itself. And I think it's really rare for people to be that brave to kind of, you know, experiment in different materials and, you know, and to put yourself out there. I mean, big respect to you for that too. So you can go to @PierceBrosnanOfficial and follow Pierce there as well. So yeah, we'll be back very soon. Thank you for listening, and thank you so much for this wonderful interview.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you, Russell. All the best. Stay well, stay happy, be bold.
We will.
Thank you.
All right, we'll stick around, Pierce, because we've got we'll have a chat afterwards, but thank you very much. Cheers, everyone.
Okay. Bye.
Cheers.
Bye.
Cheers, everyone. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram @TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.